Next time, A Taste of New York. Our guest is Kevin Baker, the best-selling author of the City of Fire trilogy that's now finished with his Stryver's Row. What is it about this world-class city that makes New York so profoundly American?
New York has really been the most fought-over place in the history of the United States, going back to slave rebellions in the 1700s and fighting Indians there, right through the Revolution, which is terrible in New York. A third of the city burned down, and more Americans died in the horrible British prison ships in the East River than in the whole rest of the war. Then you had the draft riots during the Civil War, worst riot in American history, and a riot which pretty much decided whether or not the North was going to be able to fight the war out to the finish, right up through 9/11. Very turbulent, probably the most turbulent, bloody little patch of America overall that there ever was.
Kevin Baker combines his encyclopedic knowledge of this bloody little patch with his gift for a great story when he brings us New York, New York next time. Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. A good work of fiction can be a great deal more informative than what today passes for news. Our guest, Kevin Baker, is author of the City of Fire trilogy. He bases his fiction closely on reality because he says it's very hard to outdo reality, especially in that most American of cities, New York. Having explored three pivotal moments in the nation's history, Mr. Baker believes America is again at a critical juncture, especially regarding Iraq. Still focused on New York, Mr. Baker remembers massive demonstrations both against and for the Vietnam War down New York's Fifth Avenue. The divisions within the country then were hard, he acknowledges, but
this is how a democracy operates. For most of America to kind of go off and say, ugh, that's somebody else's son, somebody else's daughter dying over there, I find a real sad betrayal of the country, particularly when everyone knows from George W. Bush on down that the war would end tomorrow if a draft were put into place. I think it's a sad abdication of responsibility by our leaders, but I think it's also, you know, our leaders are generally only as good as we are. If there was a huge grassroots movement tomorrow to say, have a draft or get out, then they would have to respond. And unfortunately, there isn't anything.
Kevin Baker is both an historian and the best-selling author of Stryver's Row, Dreamland, and Paradise Alley. He's also a columnist for American Heritage Magazine and a regular contributor to the New York Times, Harper's, and other periodicals. He was Sir Harold Evans's chief history researcher for Sir Harold's widely acclaimed bestseller, The American Century. Bill Russell and I share both Mr. Baker's love for New York and his sense that New York offers a unique window into America. So we came to this conversation with great expectations. Kevin Baker, I am quite taken with the notion that maturity can be defined, if one chooses, as the ability to hold two conflicting thoughts at once. Now, let me tell you why I say this. You have given me the opportunity to think about how I have thought over the years, first when I moved south 30 years ago. I've lived almost half my life in the South, that to understand America, you had to understand the South, and to live there was the only way you could do that. Now, hold that one thought.
Okay.
And all of my life, New York City has been this magnet. And until thinking my way through your books and thinking about you and how you look at things, I hadn't seen how conjoined they are, that both New York and the South are in some ways the same story, a different story, the same story. They feed each other. There's a tension. There's a fit. Did I make that up?
No, that's a very interesting thing to say. There is an odd symbiotic relationship between the two going back to at least the Civil War or before.
Way before.
When New York City was very much against the war, in part because all the cotton from the South came through the port. They had a lot of, the South owed them a lot of money, the financiers of New York.
And Southerners would go to New York,
right,
and that was
right.
A great place to go in the summers if you were the plantation owner.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we were told by Ann Farrow, who's written a book about that, that the mayor of New York actually proposed in a public meeting to secede from along with the South.
It's this wonderful scoundrel named Fernando Wood, a former Quaker, completely corrupt, At one point had his own personal kind of police force, which got into a brawl with the official police force on the steps of City Hall. A real character. Also built Central Park, which is what you can say, I guess, for Tammany Hall as well. But when the South was seceding, he went before, actually proposed to the city council that New York and Long Island secede and form the country of Tri-Insula. That was going to be the name. And I guess he would be the grand the grand wizard of Tri-Insula himself. And this was actually put to a vote. It lost, but it was put to a vote. You know, it reflected a great deal, you know, the fact that New York was not happy about the war. 17 papers in the city at the time. Only 5 of them endorsed Lincoln. You know, the city voted overwhelmingly for his opponents.
Another thing that you make much more clear to me is how much of America New York reflects and is,
yes.
And reminding me that the United States of America started in New York. That's a story nobody remembers.
It really did. I mean, New York has really been the most fought over place in the history of the United States, going back to slave rebellions in the 1700s and fighting Indians there, right through the Revolution, which is terrible in New York. A third of the city burned down, and more people died in the horrible British prison ships in the East River than in the whole, more Americans died in the horrible British prison ships in the East River than in the whole rest of the war. Then you had the draft riots during the Civil War, worst riot in American history, and a riot which pretty much decided whether or not the North was going to be able to fight the war out, you know, to the finish. All the way up through everything. You have Peter Zenger's trials.
Don't forget George Washington.
Yeah, well, Washington was there. But I'm just talking about the contested parts of it, you know, right up through 9/11. Very turbulent, probably the most turbulent, bloody little patch of America overall that there ever was. And all these other things happened, like Washington took the oath of office at the corner of Wall Street and Broad right there. As the first president, this is where the national government literally started. You know, this has really been this little patch of earth, this little island of Manhattan has been this place where it has been constantly fought out. Who is going to be a full American? You know, are immigrants going to be full Americans? Are black people going to be full Americans? Are gays going to have full human rights?
Are
you going to be able to smoke? Are women going to have all right? You know, right? This is where it's always been.
And this is Kevin Baker. Bill Russell did that deep inhale so that he can start when we come back in just a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Do be with us. Kevin Baker is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I promised you next.
Well, I'm thinking about New York. Because, I mean, what you've done is a masterful job, of course, of making it real in ways that it's hard to do outside of fiction.
Well, thanks.
But talking about it is sort of a paradigm in many ways for this country. It is both, you know, the quintessential urban area, you know,
right,
for the world in many ways, certainly representative. It is also a... it's almost a fusion of villages,
right?
And in some ways it is strikingly parochial and strikingly it's not rural. You never confuse it for rural, but
but so many people who are there have come from rural.
Well,
places.
They come from faraway places, as you say. A lot of immigrants came through there, and that is they defined America. Their sense of America came from that. But that village piece. Seems to be very important in this as well, particularly from a political standpoint and particularly from the stories you tell.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I would say looking back at the history of New York, it's always kind of been divided into the big city, little city. You know, this center of art and finance and culture in America, center of industry, this place with these fantastic buildings, these skyscrapers. It's still not a city in the world, such a vertical city as New York. And there still has not been any city that's such a cosmopolitan city as New York. At the same point, as you say, it is very much divided into these neighborhoods, this kind of little city existence, people just making their lives day to day, who might not leave the same block for years. I'm always amazed how infrequently I get off the Upper West Side, you know, very kind of tucked away.
It's a nice neighborhood.
Yeah. And we have a person, for instance, on our block who I call the mayor of 99th Street, which used to be a common thing. You'd have some guy, maybe he had a few connections downtown so he could help you, but he'd be the mayor of such and such block and somebody who everybody knew and would sit out there and you'd talk to him. So yeah, it is very much that kind of combination of things.
Well, David Bowie says he never goes above 14th Street.
Right, right. That's a lot of people in the village used to say.
Well, and it also, there is people tend to think, you know, outsiders tend to think of New York as a cold and alienated place, and right. it is none of that, but it is in some ways some of the strongest communities. I mean, suburbia should do so well, and in fact, most cities in the rest of the world, I think, should do so well.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's come back as a place, I think, by comparison, as you say, with suburbia. You know, I mean, New York's a tough town. It's a fast-paced town, an expensive town. But it is very much a town where you get to know your neighbors.
Well, and you use the word town.
Particularly if you're in a co-op.
That town-ness is part of what you're talking about.
Yeah. And very much, you see it, like, the public square is still alive. I can't tell you how many times I'll be out at, you know, 10 o'clock in the evening, say, coming home, and I'll look up, you know, get out of the subway, I look up, and I see the streets just pretty crowded with people, just walking back and forth, nothing special going on, you know, and you get used to it. And then only when you go to other places do you realize there's maybe, you know, maybe two or three other cities like this in the country, never mind suburban areas or rural areas.
There's another piece about New York that I've always found quite remarkable. As I say, I just sort of fell in love with it from the time I started breathing, as near as I can tell. And I've gone and gone again and gone some more and have never had anything but wonderful experiences there, even when they were stubbed my toe in Central Park when I was a kid and had to go to, what's the place that has the insane asylum?
Oh, Bellevue?
Bellevue. Here I am, 14 yeah, years old in New York at Bellevue in the middle of the night. And just time and time again, these weird things would happen, and it came out great. And I had an elderly friend who lived in the South, had always lived in the South, and she would just badmouth and badmouth and badmouth New York. I finally said, well, what was it that happened to you in New York that was so terrible that you dislike it so much? And she looked at me and she said, oh, I've never been there.
Right.
Which I think is part of that tension.
It is rather remarkable. It must be the only city, only place in America where people feel free to come there and badmouth it to your face. You know, I've been in some pretty miserable places, but I wouldn't dream of, you know, particularly if somebody's hosting me there, of saying, oh, how can you live here, you know? But but it's not for everyone. I can see that.
We, you just brought something to mind. We have claimed for some time that we actually shut down New York on a New Year's Eve.
Morning.
Yeah. Morning, actually.
New Year's
and,
Day.
And thinking that and seeing you and thinking about this book, it wasn't true. We shut down Lower Manhattan.
Yeah. Right. Because the rest of the city kept on.
My guess is if we'd gone, you know, 100 blocks north, right. We'd still be there. We wanted to keep it moving. Yeah. But I want to get to Harlem, because Harlem, of course, is a big piece of what you're talking about.
I want one more piece of this that sort of sounds extraneous. We did a program many years ago sitting in the Village with James Carse. And out of the conversation, James Carse does the history and philosophy of religion. And he said something that really shocked me, because he said, yes, Paula, you're right, whatever I'd said, that New York is very much like the Great Forest, that you have to prove yourself, that the bigness, that there's a very complex ecology, I think he even said. And there is that same sense, as we turn our attention to Harlem, of the immensity that can be experienced outside of a major forest, that you can do that in New York and get to all the levels and what's in the trees and on the ground and around and where are the things that are in the ground and in the air. As you approach it, not just Stryver's Row, but really all three of these, your City of Fire trilogy, that sense of enormous and complex must have just driven you at every turn, particularly as you thought about Harlem, the complexity of all of this.
Oh, sure. It is complex. I mean, that's a great word to use for it. It's a very complex town, complex in its social relations, complex in its buildings and maneuvering your way around it. It's, you know, it is like a forest to get into, you know. And Harlem, too, you know, another one of these great, exciting places, you know, capital of Black America for a good 20 years or so, at least. You know, by the 40s, when my book is set, it starts to be threatened a little by Chicago for that title, but still this place where generations after generations of, you know, young Black men and women came to find their way to have some sort of other existence.
Many of them from the South.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And the same reason why all these white people are coming to have another type of existence.
Many of them from the South.
From the South, from the North, from all over, as I came in 1976, when it was a very different city. and people were, you know, writing about how it was doomed and all this, and making movies about that. But it was just—it's a place you come to have a different way of living.
And I'm listening to you say that, I'm thinking of the Last Waltz, and there's a sequence in there where the two band members are talking about their first.
The Last Waltz being a movie,
Martin Scorsese, the band, 1976. Yeah.
Thank
last
you, Bill.
Concert. talking about going to New York, and it's, you know, first time you go, it's you know, it's what he said,
an adult dose.
Right.
It whoops you.
You know, and you get chewed up, and you go back and lick your wounds, then you go back, and eventually, and then you fall in love with it.
Yeah, it's you know, I think Garrison Keillor had some experience like that, where he went and failed miserably, he felt, and then went back to Minnesota and made his way back here. There's a great E.L. Doctorow passage in, I think, in City of God, where he talks about just coming back to the city on a summer weekend. And I know so much what that's like, or from a summer weekend, you know, you get back in the city, and it's, you know, in some ways a terrible place to come back to, you know, particularly in hot, you know, it's hot, it's sweaty, it's grimy, but, you know, it really, it does feel like home. It is alive. It's incredibly vivid. It keeps you going.
Well, and the complexity we're talking about, it seems that with the exception of bucolic splendor,
right,
you can, you know, the full range of human experience, we hope war aside most of the time, but in terms of human beings living with one another, it's pretty much all there, rich, poor, black, white, and all right. The combinations in between, almost all the permutations and combinations that you can put together of the human experience outside right. of, you know, warfare, open warfare.
Although that's died for a while.
Well, but it still was not, you know, right. we at least didn't have organized, more semi-organized armies marching through. But the just the rich complexity of that makes the world, it would seem, a much bigger place just by virtue of being there if you just look right. around you.
Right. And if you experience, you know, if you care to experience what other people are doing around you, you know, the level of kind of tolerance is amazing. You know, it's funny when I go someplace else and somebody will be dressed kind of funny, you know, and this will create a whole stir. And it's just kind of, you just get so used to that in New York.
Yeah, we're talking about Harlem, and when you talk about that, of course, the notion of the Harlem Renaissance comes to
right.
mind. And thinking about it in the context of your book, you know, I've always thought of that phrase Harlem Renaissance as sort of an analogy to a real Renaissance, mm-hmm. but it ain't true. And you know, I think of the people that have, and probably Cornel West and others, who have talked about the importance of incorporating the African American experience, specifically Cornel West. Into the American myth.
Right.
If it's not
right.
built in, and it seems to me that renaissance that occurred in the stories you tell about Harlem, but also about New York, is in many ways a description of in a bizarre way, the laboratory of democracy.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it about New York. I mean, it's always been, you know, again, this place where outsiders have come and kind of fought their way in. And that was the hope behind the Renaissance in the 20s, this remarkable period where all these wonderful black writers and artists and people involved in political movements such as A. Philip Randolph were there. And the real hope was that by the force of their moral argument, the hope was that by the impressiveness of the things they were doing, they would show white America that they belonged, that, you know, that these books they were writing and paintings they were painting were good enough that they would be taken seriously as American citizens. And the really sad thing was that didn't work. White New Yorkers were fascinated. They came up in droves to go to nightclubs and to, you know, and a few of them, you know, Carl Van Vechten took interest in the writers. But basically, it you know, New York was still pretty much an unofficial Jim Crow city by the end of the 20s. And, you know, and then came the Depression, which crushed everything. And Harlem suffered terribly under that, much, much more than the rest of the city even. So it was a tremendously disillusioning experience, although, you know, the writers stayed and the musicians stayed and there were still many wonderful things being done. It was really kind of a disillusioning experience in the end.
This is Kevin Baker. We will pick up and go from disillusioned to illusioned in just a moment when we return. Please do be with us. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Kevin Baker. We've been talking about Harlem because we have been reading Stryver's Row, which takes place in Harlem in the 40s. Now, you were talking about the 20s at the Renaissance, then the Great Depression. Right. You get to the 40s, and in the 40s, the war is more than just the wah-wah. There's a very important thing that begins to happen in America that for 300 years had kept black people in servitude one way or another, either in slavery or the Jim Crow kind of bondage. And the Second World War, the First World War had an impact.
Right.
The Second World War really changed things. And isn't that part of the stories you're telling here in Stryver's Row?
That really is the spark that kind of sets off Stryver's Row. It's the catharsis in America. It's the 1940s. You know, our the kind of conventional wisdom is that the home front was this kind of wonderful time where, you know, everybody was working together, the greatest generation. We were, you know, and that's part of the story. That's true. It was a great effort. We won the war through the dint of our production as much as anything else. But it was also a very turbulent time here in America. You know, people had money for the first time. They were restless. They were going all over the place. You had the word juvenile, the term juvenile delinquent came into common parlance for the first time. You had men going off to the war, women going to factories, and nobody had provided much daycare, in part because the Catholic Church didn't want it. So they felt it would kind of, you know, hurt people's morals. So, you know, you had this, you know, this going on. And then, but above all, you had these various peoples and races coming together in places where they had never been together before.
They'd been kept apart.
Right. So some of it was things like, you know, white servicemen attacking Hispanic youths and the Zoot Suit Riots out in L.A., but most of it was black and white. And the first time under pressure from the African-American community, blacks are being allowed into the industrial workforce in large numbers to work in these defense plants under A. Philip Randolph's threat that he's going to do the March on Washington 20 years early if that doesn't come about. At the same time, and they're constantly greeted by white walkouts, by riots by white workers, by out-and-out assaults on black workers.
Lynchings, murders.
And at the same time, you have all these black men being drafted and sent to the South to these basic training camps. It's still a segregated army, but they're put under white officers a lot of the time who treat them very badly. And whenever they get a pass and go into town, they're often set upon by these white lawmen who are very threatened by the idea of black men, you know, black men from the North with guns, you know, so they are.
And it's important to say that before Brown versus Board of Education in 54, all of this is absolutely legal.
Oh, yeah. And they're set upon.
Well, not all of it.
Well, not all of
it.
Yeah.
the lynchings were still illegal.
Yeah, lynchings were still illegal. But, you know,
but tolerated.
But they're set upon by these white lawmen who beat them, arrest them, sometimes shoot and kill them. Horrible incidents. And all this is coming back. They're writing letters back and there are newspaper reports back to places such as Harlem, which is getting more and more furious as the war progresses. You know, I mean, there had already been a minor riot in Harlem in 1935. And by the 40s, you know, black Americans, and particularly in places like New York, have really had it with this sort of segregation, with their living in the second class status. You know, they're charged about twice the rent that white New Yorkers are because the landlords can get away with it. You know, they have to double and triple and quadruple up. You know, they can't go to most swank New York restaurants, you know, the New York hotels. This is really, you know, and here we are, you know, fighting what's supposed to be this global war for human rights and equality. And this is just infuriating.
And then you have to add in the Jewish part of this in the in the mix between blacks and Jews who are still trying to assimilate through all of that while there's these mass murders going on in Europe.
Oh, sure. And Jews are easily the most sympathetic white groups to the black experience, unlike the bizarre things that Malcolm X writes in the autobiography where he claims Jews are the most prejudiced of white groups. You know, with all due respect to Malcolm, I suspect he didn't know too many of my Irish ancestors or Italians or many others. You know, Jews are easily the most sympathetic to this. And there is also a black sympathy for what's going on in the Holocaust. There are people like Adam Clayton Powell Jr. are raising money for relief of Jewish refugees. And there's a certain sympathy. You know, Fiorello LaGuardia is the mayor of New York at the time, and he has stopped the worst police abuses in Harlem, and he's allowed some black patrolmen on the force, and you know, seen to it that some of the official discrimination has been stopped. But still, there's this overwhelmingly racist system in New York and everywhere. And this is just really coming to a head as the summer progresses. And more and more things
Summer of 1943.
Summer of 1943, which is really the height of racial tensions all around the country. The horrendous riot in Detroit, which 34 people are killed, 600 injured, which the police join in with white mobs and attacking blacks at random on the street. So there's this stuff that's all around the country, and there are all these added provocations. Like, the military insists that the Savoy Ballroom, the greatest of the great dance halls in Harlem, be closed for moral purposes. You know, even they don't even allow alcohol in the Savoy, but you know what the military authorities are really afraid of is race mixing. You know, most of Harlem is off limits to white servicemen, but they're kind of going there anyway, and this is making people very jittery. So they're added police patrols, and these guys are on motorcycles and buzzing all around. You know, you just get this feeling of tension just kind of growing steadily throughout the summer until it finally explodes.
It seems that some of this, you know, trying to understand the flow of history, and again, a good novel is probably as good a way to understand that. It seems part of it, you had a generation that of black people who had fought in the first war.
Right.
And had been overseas.
Right.
So they had an experience in France, particularly with not being treated as second-class citizens by Europeans. They were
right.
still treated as second or third-class citizens by their own army. But you had that generation. You also had the intellectual tradition coming out of Du Bois, but also the Renaissance, so that the demonstrable inferiority of the race had been overturned, at least intellectually. And then you had the Second War experience, where again you've got people who were exposed to being overseas, who were, you know, dealing with all this rhetoric. And in many ways, it seems like this is sort of it's not quite the perfect storm, but all the pieces are now finally in place to finally do what, you know, 200 years later, what this country had promised.
Yeah,
and it still is a bloody mess.
Yeah, it's interesting the lengths people will go to maintain their prejudices. You know, black soldiers had done very well in the Spanish-American War.
Revolutionary War.
Oh yeah, I mean all through. Well, they in the Civil War they kind of saved it, yeah. but they helped take San Juan Hill under Black Jack Pershing. Who got that name because of who he was commanding. They helped take San Juan Hill. They're the most decorated unit in the war, and the reaction of the white army brass is to further segregate the military and assign black soldiers only to menial jobs. And the Navy, there's nobody who's not a cook who's black in it. So you get to World War I, and blacks actually have to go fight under the French command. But there's the unit, the 369th Harlem Hell Fighters, who do very well. And they parade back into Harlem up Fifth Avenue at the end of the war. They're led by James Reese Europe, this great early jazz musician who's the leading the company band, you know, the regiment band. They get past 110th Street and they strike up "Here Comes My Daddy Now," and everybody goes wild, you know, watching this, and you can imagine coming back. But that was considered hugely threatening by a lot of white people. There are all these riots that go on in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, and throughout the South right after the war that lead, you know, out of the direct threat that these black men have been somewhere else, as you say. They've been treated differently. You know, they've learned how to use guns.
And their expectations have changed.
Yeah, and their expectations have changed. And that leads to kind of a whole rise in expectations through it. And World War II, if really kind of the crowning, you know, the crowning, it's really kind of at the end point here of this ability of white America to keep pretending that they can go on, you know, treating blacks as inferiors.
And you also have motion pictures that were documenting all this. And I've got to believe that somewhere in there, motion pictures followed by television also changed. As I get older, I increasingly believe that we are the stories we tell.
Right.
And it's part, again, of why the work that you and others do is so important, because it's the stories we tell. And we tell a lot of stupid comic strip type stories.
Right.
And part of the trick, of course, is to get over that. And part of the trick, and you talk about how difficult it is to overcome prejudices, and it's all a matter of the context that you inhabit, and the context you inhabit is the stories, isn't it?
Right.
And Kevin Baker tells many a story,
yeah.
And we'll come back and talk about more of them in a moment, so I don't have to interrupt you even more than I just did.
Okay.
Kevin Baker. We're talking now about Stryver's Row, the other two books then in his Circle of Fire. He has done a number of things around all of American history, and we'll talk about some of them when we come back.
One is the City of Fire.
What'd I say?
Circle of Fire. Oh, that sounds like a better name for it.
Let me do that again. It was 10:16. Okay. Let me just do the close again. And some of those stories are the stories that Kevin Baker is telling in Stryver's Row in the other two of the City of Fire trilogy and the other books that he's written that concern lots of different pieces of American history. We'll all be back with some of those stories in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to be with Kevin Baker, Bill Russell, and I, Paula. We've been talking about New York because you have this luminous trilogy that is the City of Fire. You start by looking at the carnivals and all of Coney Island and Freud and Jung and all kinds of things happening in New York at that particular, through this bizarre lens that is the carny life.
That
is kind of a prism that pulls the colors apart and that puts them back together. You then take me through the New York draft riots that is in the middle of the Civil War. And now with Stryver's Row, you've brought me to 1943 and this hot, literally long, hot summer. As you talk about that particular time and place, it is easy to forget how critical Malcolm X is to this story. And we happen to be talking on the... You tell me, the 41st anniversary of the murder, the death, the assassination.
41st anniversary, I believe, is today of Malcolm X at the Audubon Ballroom.
And through this Stryver's Row, you give me an image both of New York as the landscape, if you will.
Right.
You show me white America through the eyes of black America, and you show me the emergence of a number of different things, including Adam Clayton Powell taking the junior. Taking one route of ways to address all of these things that are bubbling up of which you speak. And then you show me Malcolm X growing up and how he becomes who he becomes and how important that is.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to show kind of the different strands of this. This is really the eve of the modern civil rights movement coming out here. And, you know, I have one of the main characters, Jonah Dove, is a Harlem minister who's kind of a composite figure but has a background that's drawn very closely from Powell's. And also
pulls out of the prior story.
Yeah, and he will become kind of this the strand he's going toward is kind of the king strand of patiently but adamantly demanding full civil rights, full integration in America.
The king strand being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Malcolm is sort of more the rejectionist strand, the idea of a black nationalism. That will say, we don't care whether you hate us or not. We are going to live separately and have our own community. And if you don't like it, we will resist you by any means necessary.
Which he says until almost the end, and then he changes his tune.
Right, and then the interesting thing is too. There's a third strand, which is kind of little known for obvious reasons, but which is that of Jonah's sister, Sophia, who is actually based closely on Powell's own sister. Who has gone to pass in white society. And that's something that's pretty much faded from our national memory. But it was kind of this sad alternative that a surprising number of people resorted to.
Need to say what that is.
Black people passing as white. Something which in and of itself puts the lie to racism. I mean, it shows how ridiculous racism as a biological concept is. Jefferson released some of his slaves in Philadelphia at the end of the 18th century because they could pass for white. You picture how many, Americans are, who think of themselves as pure white are in fact not, think of how many
African-Americans are. Well, and we are all out of Africa, as Malcolm was telling us.
Race is just, it's below contempt as a biological concept.
It's also wrong.
Oh, of course, it's absurd. But you can see how this absurdity, how people wanted to react to this absurdity. Some people feel like, rather than be excluded from this bigger stage, this bigger society all around me, I'm going to go off and pass into it, which led to terrible, really heartrending stories. Families being split on this, where people kind of denying their ancestry, you know, but you can understand why they would choose that as an ultimate alternative.
I will say I've often wondered, I found it remarkable that more people didn't. Because the consequences of being black in America still today, but certainly up until the civil rights movement and certain parts of the country well past that, the cost were substantial and given, and you do a wonderful job of, you know, of dealing with both the opportunity and the why not, you know, is it my responsibility to carry my whole race along? Or should I, you know, am I going to be a good American and do what's best for me?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a Jonah's dilemma. Jonah can also pass his grandmother from, who I meant to talk about in Paradise Alley, the previous book, was white, and he looks white, and he can pass too. And he's wondering, you know, he feels unequipped to go and guide his people through this crucible. This horrible time, you know, he sees what's happening to Jews in Europe in the Holocaust, and you know, the Holocaust didn't come about overnight. Hitler didn't come out of nothing. These concepts came from people, from social Darwinists, some of whom were treated quite respectably, talking about
many of whom were
sort of
Americans who had invented eugenics.
Oh, American professors. You know, there was John Burgess, who kind of, his picture was in the library at my alma mater at Columbia University for many years, and they redid the library recently, and the picture just kind of vanished. And good thing too. But he had been a leading social Darwinist, and these are people who believed, you know, this kind of got into this philosophy of, well, these other people were inferior, maybe they should just be made to go away. Through eugenics, as you say, you know, fortunately, people like Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist, you know, and that people talked about that for 70, 80 years, and eventually someone got in a position to actually do this. And this is what Jonah is seeing, and he's terrified that, you know, they're doing this to Jews who are, you know, in terms of skin color, white. You know, look, here's black people in the United States, all in these separate ghettos, you know, maybe we're next.
It's, you know, it's the eugenics. It's a lot of other pieces. And I'm off somewhere.
Well, what I wanted to pick up on is, again, in this Harlem setting.
Right.
In the 60s, I went to Harlem with friends. I'd worked at a camp that was integrated both economically and racially, which was an interesting thing. It was after the civil rights movement, and me, I always figure, oh, well, that's done now. No. But I remember Harlem being the place where it was hard to sleep because the gunfire through the night was somewhat surprising. But this whole sense within Harlem that you can see all of America within Manhattan, within Harlem, within what's happening, back and forth, going to the war, from the war, people coming in and out, fertilization, cross currents, if you will. You also bring in the character of Elijah Muhammad. And it was interesting to me to watch you follow that story, because my uncle, who was a conscientious objector in the Second World War, was in prison in Milan, Michigan.
Oh, really? So he knew Elijah
and
Muhammad.
Well, he tried to because my uncle was trying to integrate the prison. And Elijah would sit there and say, you're a white devil, don't talk to me.
Right.
So to meet, if you will, and my uncle didn't have much use for him. My uncle tried to be pretty open, but he didn't think well of Elijah Muhammad because of the racism.
Right.
And I keep thinking as I read these books, you're really talking about white supremacy. It isn't just racism. It's very explicitly white supremacy, which sets a different level of expectation. Well, racism, you know, white supremacy is that which has infected this whole story.
Yes.
So that it's more than just race. It is this pernicious pyramid to which one cannot go unless you're going to pass, and then you have violated all your own integrity.
Right. You know, and that was kind of the experience of Elijah Muhammad, originally Elijah Poole, son of Georgia, grew up in Georgia, and, you know, got and had this terrible life here. You know, he was somebody who, you know, there was...
Here being Georgia.
Okay. Had this horrible life in Georgia. He was in these small towns. There was simply no school for him to go to, period, after, I think, the fifth grade. So even though he's this very bright guy, he's got to just drop out and become a manual laborer. His biggest aspiration is to become a Pullman porter, which he hopes to do someday.
Which turns out to be a pivotal place in American history.
Yeah, definitely. And there's all these terrible things going on. You know, a young friend of his is lynched at a very young age. He, you know, sees other lynchings. He goes into these white general stores where clothing of lynching victims is being sold in neat little square cutouts. Postcards are being sold. Common practice.
As souvenirs of
South
the lynch.
And North at the time. Yeah, it's amazing how many pictures of grinning white people there are around mutilated bodies.
He doesn't have much fun in the North either.
And finally he gets out of Georgia. And it's this period, too, where people are just burning churches left and right in Georgia right after the First World War. So he gets out. He goes to Detroit.
Takes
maybe
his family
this will
with
be something
him.
Bitter. You know, takes his family. Sees it, you know, almost as a messiah figure. You know, he's Moses. He's going to take him to the promised land in the North. And that turns out to not be so great. He's in Detroit. Life is miserable for him there. He becomes this full-blown alcoholic. There's no jobs. It's the start of the Depression. He's living in this little shack with his family. His wife and son have to drag him home at night from these dives. And then he meets this utterly bizarre, typically American character, Wallace D. Fard, who has started his own religion, and Elijah Muhammad is born.
Smitten.
Smitten.
Well, and that religious piece is very important. Let me go away so you can come right back and start there, Bill. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula, and Kevin Baker, the three of us, invite you to return. We'll talk about Strivers Row and a great deal more. Please do come back with us. Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are pleased and honored to be with Kevin Baker. This strain that is this, as you say, very American creature, this kind of Barnum and Bailey guy.
Right.
Who, in a way, almost fits into your Dreamland book, who has invented this religion. Elijah becomes smitten with it. The religious strain that is so important in America is also reflected in lots of different ways throughout Strivers Row.
Sure.
Bill?
It's even more than that. You were talking about racism and eugenics, and we also there is in this country a curious support system, which is Calvinism.
Yeah, yeah.
That is manifested, and it goes into this wonderful complex play of the church people and Malcolm in New York.
Right.
And I'm sitting here listening to you and thinking about, you know, it's almost a straight line from there to 1968.
Right.
We were talking
right.
about Taylor Branch before we started.
Which part of 1968?
Well, the split of the civil rights movement into the Black Power movement and those people who still believed in a nonviolent approach and in integration. And I was thinking that's a long arc, but it's not. It's only a quarter of a century. It's a generation from
right.
the time you're talking about, 1943. It's literally 25 years.
Yes.
1968.
Yeah.
And in that context, that is just a stunningly rapid change. And I think part of what makes, again, your book so interesting is all the forces that have been repressed are all coming together, you know, essentially in three characters.
Right, right. Yeah, it's very interesting, as you say, with the religion. I mean, I think it really speaks to people's ability, to Americans' particular ability to impose their own reality on this country in both a good and a frightening way. You know, Fard and Elijah Muhammad can seem like very bizarre characters. The theology of the Nation of Islam can seem like a very bizarre one. But as James Baldwin points out in The Fire Next Time, you know, you look at this and it's, you know, it's not really that much more bizarre than a lot of religious texts. And like most religions, it really has its power in its metaphorical value. And the main metaphor, you know, the main thing was saying underneath all these metaphors and these stories about how and where black people came from was that African Americans had been robbed of their culture, robbed of their heritage, which was a very true thing, which a lot of other people were saying at the time too, such as Garvey beforehand and many black nationalists afterwards. So you can see where that appeal was. But it's in general too. It's an interesting analogy to You know, and Elijah and Fard were hardly the first people to make up a religion in America. This Joseph Smith, you know, staring at the plates of the Angel Moroni with his Seer's stone in upstate New York.
That turns into the Church of the Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, it turns into the Mormons. You know, I mean, you know, for like 30 years, there was a religion coming out of upstate New York every other day, you know.
It's called the Burned Over District for a reason.
Yeah, it's just this amazing vitality and, or from another viewpoint, looniness. But also, you know, it's an interesting analogy, too, to like what became kind of more mainstream black theology, Christian theology about America, too. There was this feeling that that the black church in America was God's hidden church in the wilderness, with that acceptance of it and acceptance of the black community by whites was necessary for America's redemption. You know, and there's even some black theologians even broke it down into a like the three ages of man, the Semitic, which was God's original message to the Jews, and the Japhetic, which was Europeans spreading Christianity around the world, and then the Hamitic, which was supposed to be living a real Christian existence in America. And that's really something that influenced King and that King operated on, this real attempt to create the beloved community, which was one of the great moments, the most admirable moments in American history.
Well, King, I think, I know Taylor Branch quotes, I think King, saying that the democracy is really an exercise in nonviolence.
Right.
And again, looking, I mean, you tell a story that is, you know, just eaten up with violence.
Right.
And yet it, you know, and yet the real drivers are not violence, they're ideas.
Yeah, I think that's very true ultimately in America, and I hope so. But you know, this is a violent country, and we are kind of in denial about just how violent we are. In fact, we're probably less violent now than we've ever been in our history, at least domestically, which is certainly a good thing.
Yeah, but we are imposing that violence on other people all over the world.
Yeah, there are. You know, we do have like a sort of cavalier attitude still toward our militarism, but. But certainly, you know, in New York now, too, it's a much less violent place than it has been most of its time. You know, that is certainly like, you know, and certainly King's idea to go to nonviolence was such an amazing departure from it. And that's one of the things in this whole trilogy of books that I find very interesting and incredible, a great part of the American experience is all these different groups coming over here and forcing their way into American democracy with their own different folkways. You know, if Du Bois called it, you know, it's just this, you know, the Irish kind of idea of the clan village coming over. Okay, you hate us. Well, we're going to, you know, take over the government. You know, we're going to form our own political machines. Tammany Hall. And, you know, and do it, you know, nonviolently, but do it, you know, take over the, you know, the political Jewish immigrants coming over. Well, we're going to form labor unions and we're really going to call America on its promises, you know, and this, you know, of course, African Americans have been here just about as long as whites, you know, not really immigrants, but more of an outsider group than anybody else, and kind of, okay, rallying around these churches, practically the only institutions allowed to them. You know, well, we're going to turn these into these political, social institutions as well, and we will be heard. You know, we're going to, you say you're Christians, well, we're going to call you on your Christianity. And I think it's a fascinating thing.
Well, it's also the genius of democracy. I mean, it's, you know, that, you know, allowed to operate within, you know, within the, how to say, the more or less prescribed, though dynamic, playing field. All those rich ideas coming together and struggling. We tend to think of democracy as a deductive process.
Deductive.
Yeah. Deduced from the Constitution, you know, by logical principles, and it's not. It's the other way around. It emerges from this conflict that you're talking about. And again, New York is right at the center of it. This is where people just come eyeball to eyeball with one another. They can't get away from one another.
Yeah, there's you know, there's I had a professor who Harry Wachtel, wonderful professor who was a counsel to King and the SCLC, and one of the things
I think he was a lawyer too.
Yeah, great. He had been a very successful lawyer, and then had this, you know, built up this great practice and made a lot of money, and then decided he was just going to go and helped the civil rights movement, and then, you know, taught for years afterwards and helped a lot of poor feeble-minded undergrads like myself. But he had this whole idea of, you know, he would always quote, I believe it was, I think it was Frederick Douglass talking about power and how power cedes nothing without a demand. You know, it really is democracy.
That would be C-E-D-E.
C-E-D-E's
nothing. Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah, without a demand. It's true. It's like democracy is struggle. And I think that's one of the things I'm trying to get through in these books. And some people have been surprised by how violent the past is or how nasty the past is, the way people lived. But, you know, this really is the American path. These really, all the stuff that went on in World War II, while terrible at times on the home front and sad, but this is also how democracy works. People force their way in.
Well, it's also, I mean, democracy is the alternative to brute force. And brute derived either from divinity or from aristocracy.
Or economics, just plain old money brute force.
But brute force, you know, it's not just physical brute force, it's also economic brute force. And democracy is the only known cure, but it's only if you use it.
Right. And I think democracy at times has its own violent side and legitimately violent in a way. I mean, you know, I don't think there was any other way you were going to stop slavery without violence, you know, without British ships and the Union Army. You know, I don't know if you were going to necessarily eliminate slavery. I think it, you know, and in a way, and that was a great democratic army of the Union Army.
That's certainly what John Brown thought.
Oh yeah, John Brown had this. You know, he was going to set up the guerrilla war,
and he was going to do it because he believed the Declaration of Independence and he believed the Bible
and the Constitution.
Yeah,
and the Constitution. Sorry, it was the Constitution. That's right.
Yeah,
and these documents really drove him, and he wasn't crazy.
Oh yeah, no, these were all the, you know, this is, you know, where this came from. And the Union Army was, in many ways, this great democratic institution.
Many
faults, you know, burning down half of Georgia, not a good thing. But, you know, it was this thing, this army of the people. And that's the thing about New York, too. New York is the first, as Moynihan put it, the first great city in human history to really be run by the people, not just some aristocratic class. And, you know, they make a lot of mistakes. You know, there aren't a lot of great New York mayors. You know, the city is, you know, is run haphazardly at times and run badly at other times. But overall, I think it's been a tremendous triumph. And I think a triumph of democracy.
Let's come back in just a moment so that I don't have to interrupt yet again. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Kevin Baker is with us. Bill Russell, of course, is here. We're talking about the whole City of Fire trilogy, particularly Stryver's Row, that takes us to 1943, and Malcolm X. Please be with us when we return. Welcome back. A few more minutes with Kevin Baker. Bill Russell has given me the opportunity to go next. As I read Stryver's Row, and I didn't thoroughly read Dreamland and Volume 2.
Paradise Alley.
Thank you. Yeah. Knowing also that you are the researcher behind now Sir Harold Evans, Harry Evans, two big looks at America. Both the American Century and then They Made America.
Well, I was only the researcher on the first one.
Okay, well then I take half of that credit back.
David Leffer is a wonderful researcher that the second one.
That said, you've looked at this nation. You've really thought about this country.
Right.
You've explored it. You don't know what you think till you write it. So you've massaged it. You've thought about it. You've learned things so that you could turn it into dialogue. I kept thinking, why is he doing this? What does he want me to know about now?
Well, I think with any historical text, novel or straight history, I think what one is trying to do is inform the now from it. Without history, it's as if we were born yesterday, as someone said. You know, it's I think we have to kind of, you know, I think without kind of knowing the American past, we are unable to really assess the present and the future.
And how do you assess our present and future?
Well, I've been very disappointed to kind of see the indifference in the country above all. You know, I mean, my viewpoint is, you know, very liberal by today's standards. I'm kind of an old school, you know, New Deal Democrat, I guess.
Was pretty conservative at the time.
Robert Kennedy type of liberal, I guess. But, you know, beyond the whole left-right thing, I think it's what I find most disillusioning about what's going on right now is how uninvolved so much of the population is. You know, for the president to announce a global, worldwide fight for democracy and follow that with massive tax cuts and without a draft is stunning. I mean, I think it's, you know,
it's a lie.
I mean, I remember, you know, the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam and massive demonstrations for the war, People would come out, huge demonstrations down Fifth Avenue in New York for the war, support our troops. You know, whether you agree or disagree with either side, I think it made for a much more vibrant democracy, hard as those years were in many ways. And they were hard. The divisions were hard. But, you know, this is how a democracy operates. For most of America to kind of go off and say, oh, that's somebody else's son, somebody else's daughter dying over there, I find a real sad betrayal of the country, particularly when everyone knows from George W. Bush on down that the war would end tomorrow if a draft were put into place. And I think that's a really sorry statement about where we are. I mean, this country has, you know, had other bad moments. We've shown remarkable ability to rally from them, and I hope we can do that as well. But I think we really have to look ourselves in the face right now and see what, you know, look in the mirror and say what's going on.
Talked recently with President Jimmy Carter, who shares a lot of your concerns,
right.
And his take is that Americans, given sufficient information,
right.
Correct information, will behave appropriately. He's a little more optimistic than I am, but
right.
But it seems the challenge, and again, this goes to what you've done, knowing something about the world you live in. Our news media have done a fairly miserable job.
Yeah,
I find that I'd learn at least as much from your fiction as I read, you know, reading your local newspaper. And in fact, in terms
your
of
local newspaper,
in terms of reliability and utility, I find you know it much much higher. Which I guess is by way of saying that the people in responsible positions, it seems, not only the walk-around folks, but people in responsible positions have an obligation that's simply not being fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, and in terms of my books, too, they are based very closely upon reality because I find you really can't outdo it, particularly not American history, which is so amazing and colorful. I'm trying to personalize it, individualize it, but, you know, almost everything in these books actually happened, you know. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sad abdication of responsibility by our leaders. But I think it's also, you know, our leaders are generally only as good as we are. You know, I mean, if there was a huge grassroots movement tomorrow to say, have a draft or get out, then they would have to respond. And unfortunately, there isn't anything, you know.
Or if there is, it has not yet come to a crystalline place.
Yeah, I think it will. I think, unfortunately, at this point, I think dialogue is kind of broken down in the sense that a majority of Americans are at least passively supportive of what this administration is doing, both at home and abroad. And they will not be moved, I don't think, by any more dialogue. They'll only be moved by seeing the consequences of these actions. And we shall see what the consequences are. I had the feeling they're going to be very dismal, you know, perhaps dire. But I think that's... You know, that's the only thing that's why the political dialogue has become so shrill, I think, because a lot of Americans now are operating on a basis of, well, this is the Lord's will, or this is, you know, they have some innate faith, or they just don't care. And I think that's, you know, that indifference and that kind of blind faith will only be shattered by the failure of these policies.
Perhaps some dialogue.
Or vindicated by it.
Dialogue might, in fact, then come out of that.
Yeah.
We are the stories we tell. You left me hanging with Malcolm, and you've called this a trilogy.
Right.
I want to know what's coming next.
Well,
the
next contract I have is a bit of a break. I'm going to do a history of New York City baseball. So, particularly the 20th century, so that'll be something different. That'll be fun.
And then?
But then more novels, more historical novels on New York. I think particularly the post-war period when the city became a very different place, became a very rich place and also a somewhat corrupt place, but still a very vibrant, interesting city.
Stories to be told. We will stay tuned. We hope that you will be back, Kevin.
8 million stories in the Naked City, or 9 million now.
Kevin Baker's Stryver's Row completes his City of Fire trilogy and refreshes our memory of both Malcolm X and his era. The other two novels, Dreamland and Paradise Alley, are as dramatically entertaining as they are important to our understanding of the real America. We enthusiastically congratulate Mr. Baker and we thank him for sharing his stories with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.